Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and this week's show is brought to you by Duo Security. Big thanks to Duo for that. And a little bit later on, we'll be chatting with Duo Security's very own Dave Lewis about some BeyondCorp stuff. BeyondCorp is, in my view, the enterprise computing model of the future, and Dave will be along after this week's news to talk about some of the finer points. But first up, of course, it is time for a look back on the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, what a week for data breaches. Holy dooly.
Yeah, it has been a jumbo week. We've seen a number of them fall out. And of course, the really big one that's been making the headlines and, of course, is the extra large one. The Marriott hotel chain has got itself owned. Apparently, any of the hotels that are in the part of the kind of wider Starwood group at Marriott, all of the people who've stayed there for like the last 7 years, something like that, have had all the data stolen, including, you know, details of their stays, names, address, emails, passwords, passport information if you submitted that. Apparently attackers were in the network since 2014 or perhaps before.
We don't really know. ASCII shrug.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently a whole bunch of it got walked out of the network in an encrypted blob to avoid whatever, you know, limited DLP
they had in the environment. I loved that, man, when I'm reading about this and they're like, it seems like the attackers encrypted the data to avoid the DLP, and I'm like, that says more about DLP than the attackers.
Yeah, it really does. It's funny that, you know, the data was not encrypted at Marriott's end, apart from, you know, hashing the passwords, presumably, and the credit cards that they claim are encrypted. But yeah, the fact the attackers then encrypt it so that they can get it out of the network is kind of funny. The details about, you know, credit card information, we're not really sure. Marriott says it was encrypted, but then have also kind of mumbled about the fact that maybe the keys were lying around there too, which, you know, if you've been in the network that long, the chances that you don't have the keys when you've been there since 2014 is essentially zero. So
that tends to suggest to me that maybe they weren't using a HSM.
Well, I mean, even then, right, if you've been there that long, you probably, you know, survived the cross HSM upgrades and key loads and stuff. So, yeah. Anyway, somebody's having a bad time at Hotel Group HQ. Krebs has done a write-up, of course, comparing and contrasting it with all of the myriad other hotel groups that have been owned. And I think that's really the key thing, you know, for everyone. I mean, whether or not you stayed at a Marriott property, you know, all of the hotels are owned all of the time. And, you know, you should probably assume that all your stuff is nicked all the time.
Starwood was actually acquired by Marriott in 2015, and then like days afterwards, Starwood disclosed a breach, right? So like it looks like they might have been stung via acquisition. Not that I'm suggesting that Marriott's security would be any better. I'm wondering about the motivation here, right? Because I think a giant cache of passport numbers and movements of people, that is the sort of stuff that is of interest to intelligence agencies. So, okay, it could be a crime-based attack, but it could also be SIGINT as well.
I mean, I think that's definitely an and situation rather than an or. I mean, I'm sure there are both. I mean, the idea that intelligence agencies wouldn't be in the hotel systems as, you know, airline reservations and all that kind of travel thing to keep an eye on who's moving where and who they should rendition where and, you know, whose hotel rooms they have to evil maid. You know, we assume that that's what intel agencies do. I mean, it'd be kind of irresponsible not to. But, I mean, crime groups as well as, I think, rather than instead of.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, Marriott is also being sued. The lawsuit announced mere hours after the breach.
And, apparently there's, a pair of class action suits filed already in the US. One of them is going for what actually sounds like an extremely reasonable sum of $25 per record, to cover people's costs for, you know, having to cancel their credit cards.
That's going
to
add up, though, isn't it?
Monitoring. But, yes, that adds up to $12.5 billion US dollars.
I mean, I love it. It's like a Dr. Evil figure, that one.
Yeah, it is. Pretty funny. But, you know, it's hard not to argue that, for an individual person, $25 really doesn't cover how much of a pain in the ass this is. But, $12.5 billion, that's quite a lot of Spondulex for the Marriott Group to you know, actually have to put up with them. And we've seen other data breaches, like what was the Yahoo one? They paid, $80 million for 500 million users? So $12.5 billion maybe seems a little steep by that standard.
It's optimistic, but you would say, right? Quora is it Quora or Quora? I don't even know.
I always assumed Quora, but, I mean, it could be Quora. I mean, that's given that it's...
Uh, that's true. Wow, I never thought of that. God,
I didn't
I'm
until
stupid.
I saw the headlines.
But you know that website where all the finest knowledge is dispensed? They have announced a data breach of 100 million users. Doesn't look like anything particularly sensitive here.
No, email addresses, hash passwords, apparently also included potentially private information, like private messages if you exchange non-public information or you, you know, asked questions where... Actually, I gather they had an anonymous question and answer feature and that there was no information about the identity of those people, which is good. The fact they didn't collect that information means it didn't get stolen. So, you know, thumbs up
I don't think we're going to see any hot and heavy chats being dumped here, though. Well, you'd think even if they're private messages. Although people are weird, right?
People are people, man. People will have hot and heavy chats in any forum you give them, I'm pretty sure. But yeah, I think the main thing that most people are surprised about with this breach is that they had 100 million users. You got to wonder how many are bots or spam accounts or whatever else. But, you know.
I mean, the most useful thing here is going to be, you know, matching email addresses to hashed passwords, right? Like just add it to your database.
Yes, and that's we haven't yet seen specifics about what sort of hashing was in play, like whether it was good,
my money's on MD5.
I mean, yeah, it's probably going to be MD5.
Because they probably asked, iteration. Like on Quora or Quora, they probably asked, how should we hash the passwords? And I am sure that the most popular answer would have been MD5, if not MD4.
Yeah, well, if you'd asked on Yahoo Answers, they probably would have said, what, NTLM? So, you know, maybe MD5 is better.
Wild, man, wild. Dell also talking about some sort of very limited breach, attempted breach more so.
Yeah, they're not. This one's a little bit vague on the reporting, but it sounds like some kind of Dell customer information system, like something on the website, got itself owned and they lost, you know, emails, names, passwords, hashed passwords. Once again, no details about the hashing algorithm, as is the, you know, the style at the time. But yeah, we don't really know. You know, this one is, you know, I imagine Dell have gone for the let's announce our little breach in the middle of all these other really big stories so that it doesn't
day,
get
man.
PR. Like, perfect, good job, Dell PR. Yep. Well managed.
Yeah, no, I agree. Hat tip to the PR team at Dell. Meanwhile, Sky TV in Brazil left like 34 million people's details in a, you know, Elasticsearch, no authentication. Oops.
Yeah, got picked up by the Shodan scanner, and eventually someone, you know, looked, figured out what it was from the data, and then reported it through to Sky Brazil, who then didn't reply, but apparently have actually now added password authentication to their Elasticsearch. Had something like half a terabyte of data in their Elastic, with, you know, customer information and API keys and logs and all sorts of things. So, yeah, not great for them.
Now, last week, you know, Alex Stamos was a guest on the show, and we did have a bit of a discussion about Jamal Khashoggi's murder and NSO Group's possible involvement there, because it is known that they were selling tools to the Saudi Arabian government. Some of Jamal Khashoggi's associates are alleging that they were owned by the Saudis using NSO tools. One of those associates now is suing NSO Group over its possible involvement in this whole thing. This is going to be interesting, and it also follows on from other lawsuits that have been filed against NSO. And I wonder if this is going to eventually be a way for companies like this to be held accountable. I mean, it would be tragic if someone has to die before that's a success, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a new, adds a bit more of a wrinkle to the story because, you know, when we were talking previously, while I listened through to, you know, you and Alex talking about this last week, you know, there was, you know, sort of vague details and we'd seen some information about this guy, you know, being compromised by the Saudis. But this lawsuit's kind of brought forth a bunch of other information about, you know, the pressure that was applied on him by the Saudi government, including a visit from a couple of Saudi agents to him in Montreal, you know, where he recorded the conversation of them, you know, kind of explaining what was going to happen. You know, that he was going to return to Saudi and be made rich and forget about all the bad things he was saying and everyone would be happy, or, you know, bad things would happen. And then subsequent to that meeting, he got, you know, sent a link to install the Pegasus malware, which he didn't fall for. And then at the same time, a couple of his family members got rolled up in the middle of the night and thrown in jail and are being tortured. And so that kind of...
Sell malware to those guys.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this kind of, you know, gives some context to, you know, this is not just you're selling a tool for law enforcement, right? Or as Alex said last week, this is not just, you know, like selling it to a Western law enforcement agency. Like, this really is being used to oppress people who, you know, are, you know, not people who don't deserve to be oppressed, I guess is what I'm saying. And yeah, having this out and a bit more out in the open, you know, really having some concrete examples to point to, and whether or not they can then draw a direct line, you know, obviously we're not going to see Khashoggi's phone show up and get forensically analyzed by Citizen Labs, but, you know.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that he had his phone on him, because I think there was some reporting around the time that his fiance had his phone. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't say that just yet.
Actually, that's
we
true.
Won't,
yeah.
We won't see his phone, because when that whole bullshit story about the Apple Watch possibly picking up the conversations, which was obviously a pretty bad attempt to cover up bugging of an embassy, but that's when it was pointed out that his fiancée had the phone outside the embassy, and it was unlikely that the watch would have been able to transmit audio to the phone. So, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe someone's doing a teardown of it right now. Let's see, because that would be some pretty full-on evidence there. Back in Australia now, and it looks like the two major political parties here have reached a compromise on the controversial assistance and access bill.
Yeah, so this is your legislation that suggests that tech companies will be compelled to provide assistance to law enforcement, and the exact details of what that assistance would look like and for what crimes were the things that your political parties were kind of arguing about. So what's the end agreement on, you know, what crimes it's for and what this looks like?
So what looks to have happened here is originally they tried to sort of just vaguely legislate that they could ask tech companies to do things that wouldn't cause systemic weaknesses. But then obviously you can't really define what a systemic weakness is in a PhD, let alone in a small piece of legislation, right? So that was one issue that the ILP had. So what's happened is, as a result of this compromise, the Attorney General and the Communications Minister have to agree that whatever is being proposed isn't a systemic weakness. And if the tech company disputes it, a retired judge and a subject matter expert get brought in to sort of mediate that. So that's the compromise. I don't know that it goes far enough in terms of being a compromise, but it's something. And the other issue is the ALP sort of insisted on this being limited for use in, you know, really serious crimes like, you know, murder, terrorism, child exploitation, things like that. And I think what they're doing is they're probably going to pass, I'm not 100% sure on this, but it looks like they might pass some sort of interim bill and then, you know, hammer out the full complete one in coming months.
Yeah, and I guess the interesting thing is going to be, assuming that they do, then what form this takes, you know, in actual implementation. Because, I mean, it's, you know, it's certainly one thing to have a framework that describes what they want, but then actually implementing it, like making the rubber meet the road for the tech companies, you know, for an Apple or Google or a Facebook, you know, to actually say, well, what specific technical assistance are you imagining we're going to give you for WhatsApp, for example?
Yeah. Yeah, no, agreed. And I think it is a... I think one interesting thing about this legislation that, and look, I understand why people were getting so emotional over this one, because the bill was pretty vague, and it seemed to allow for things that were wider in scope than what I understand the agencies and police services to actually be looking to do. So it's my feeling that probably once this is passed, we won't hear a lot about it, because I can't imagine they're going to be asking for giant intrusive capabilities to be introduced. And yeah, I mean, the fact that we've got a law on the books that could, under some sort of interpretations, kind of allow that, I think that is a concern. But as I say, I think once this is passed, it's going to go away until the government tries to push it too far, you know, some sort of technical capability notice, and that'll leak, and then it'll all be a shitstorm. That's my feeling for what's going to happen here.
Yeah, that does seem likely. It'll just kind of potter along quietly until they really, you know, screw it up, and then yeah, we'll see a bunch of fallout.
One thing the Australian agencies are asking for, and it's interesting because it seems like the Five Eyes countries are really synchronized on this issue, because we've seen public comments out of the GCHQ saying, hey, you know how you can have your iMessage on your iPad and your iMessage on your iPhone, and every time you add a new device to your iMessage, you get a notification saying a new device has been added. We just want the ability to add ourselves as a device into these communications under warrant and to suppress that warning, right? So that's the sort of stuff that they're after. Does that break E2E? I don't know. It depends who you ask, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a good guest blog post on Lawfare by a guy from the NCSC UK GCHQ, you know, kind of talking about that particular aspect of it. And it's been reported a number of ways. But I think the blog post really kind of makes it clear that they are attempting to differentiate the actual, like, crypto mechanism from the identity mechanism, which, you know, is a thing that...
It's a bit Weasley, though. Come on.
Well, I mean, it is a technical option, right? I mean, it's a way to do it that involves not breaking the end-to-end encryption, because that's one of the, you know, the sort of the key escrow mechanism of the Clipper chips in the 90s clearly is dumb. And that actually uses the word dumb, which, I mean, having GCHQ say key escrow is dumb, I think that isn't too easily. Like, that is actually a good place for us to be.
Yeah, you mentioned key escrow there, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but you know, since we collectively worked out that the only way for authorities to get reliable unlocks on phones was like that Ray Aussie key escrow scheme, because, you know, phone keys are generated with PBKDF2, et cetera, et cetera. I've noticed that the various agencies have kind of put that problem on the back burner for now, so I think they've thrown it in the too hard basket for the time being, and, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It is. And we are seeing, you know, they are accepting the world that has been built around them to a certain extent, right, where we do have, you know, good quality hardware that is hard to break into, even given physical access. And we have, you know, widely deployed end-to-end crypto. And so they're going after the thing that is left, which is identity management, because that's really hard. And that's the suggestion here, is that the, you know, the operators of these encrypted services do have to provide an entity management. And they could just not mention the fact that, you know, the spooks have been included in the conversation. That's kind of where they're heading with this. I mean, it doesn't solve all the problems that they've got. And I think the, you know, the idea that they would do that, I mean, there are some real downsides to it. I mean, it reduces trust in the identity management system of, say, iMessage or, you know, or WhatsApp. And that is really, you know, an important part of the platform. If you asked Facebook, you know, about how it felt, if you asked Alex how he felt about Facebook, you know, being able to lie to its users about the identity of who they're communicating with as a service, you know, that would be a thing I imagine that they would stick in their craw, you know, but perhaps less so than, you know, replacing AES with something that the spooks can break, or replacing the key exchange, you know?
Yeah, but look, I mean, one thing that I'm finding encouraging here is that this debate is getting more finely tuned. It's the people are sort of honing in on some key issues where maybe something can be done that isn't a disaster, right? And that's positive.
Yeah, the guest blog post on Lawfare also is really cool, because, you know, it does actually come out and say, like, this is a technical debate. We need to have specific technical examples of how this is going to work. We can't just do it at the very high level, like that piece of legislation in Australia, where we just don't have any specifics yet. We do have to have specific details and have a technical conversation about how it works, as well as the, you know, kind of bigger how it fits into society. Like, these things are meshed together and not necessarily separable. Which, you know, that's a nuance that we haven't had in the debate before, I think, and that's good.
Now, look, we've got a few stories from Australia and New Zealand this week of global consequence, I think. But the Defence Department here was apparently left exposed to Chinese, you know, state-backed hackers, according to this report in the Australian Financial Review, due to the poor security practices of its contractors. Now, this comes as no surprise, but it's interesting seeing it written about in a major newspaper.
Yeah, and I mean, on the back of, you know, some of the supply chain attacks, both, you know, in terms of software and in terms of services that we've seen over the last couple of years, like, this is an important thing to see talked about in public. This particular breach, they haven't identified, like, who the contractor was or exactly how it occurred, but it has apparently triggered off a fairly wide-ranging review in the Australian Defence Department about how those relationships work with the vendors, with the suppliers. The reporting ties it together with the CloudHopper attacks, which are then, you know, attributed to China breaking in through managed service providers and then pivoting onwards into the downstream customers as being a thing, you know, specifically targeting this kind of organization. But there isn't a suggestion that that's, I mean, it's tied together in the story, but I don't know that that's necessarily, you know, the exact case we're talking about here.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, and it's not just Australia's DOD having trouble. Apparently, think tanks here have been targeted through watering hole attacks. Think tanks, universities, that sort of stuff. It's all the usual China stuff, really.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting, I suppose, in the past has been that, you know, essentially every think tank in the US has been targeted by the Chinese so that they can get a, you know, an eye read on what's going on and what the advice being given, all that kind of thing is. But, you know, obviously Australia and elsewhere. Well, I don't know that we have think tanks in New Zealand. We're not very thinky. But, you know, the idea that they would be targeted elsewhere is entirely reasonable. In this case, the reporting in Australia is about this one called the Lowy Institute, a kind of a foreign affairs think tank, as well as fairly widespread breaches at the Australian National University in Canberra, which, you know, by virtue of its proximity to the government, has quite a lot of ties in. Apparently, the ANU were breached and had so little logging that they didn't even know what happened.
Yeah.
And they're relying on the spooks to, you know, sniff their tubes and tell them, you know, what got exfilled.
No logging. That's a paddling. Pretty much is what's happening to them at the moment. Now, as I said, you know, there's a few stories from Australia and New Zealand at this time. Of course, you know, New Zealand was going to use Huawei for its 5G rollout. Someone obviously gave them the memo because that decision has been reversed. They've been banned. Huawei has been banned from these New Zealand builds on the advice of the GCSB, New Zealand Signals Intelligence Agency. What can you tell us about this? This is your country. Well, you know, what can you tell us?
Well, I mean, describing it as a ban is a little bit exaggerated. In this case, the New Zealand telcos and other operators are required to submit their network designs to the spooks to be, you know, kind of assessed for review, and then they get given a yes, you can or no, you can't, depending on national security impact. One of the big telcos submitted their plans for a Huawei 5G cell network and got told no. The spin put on it here was that they can come back with some modified designs that make it less risky, but at the same time, the reason this is different for 5G is because somehow 5G is magically way more integrated and it's not safe to have Huawei in any bit of it, unlike the existing Huawei 3 and 4G networks we already have in production. Apparently it's somehow different, which, you know, didn't make any sense. But yeah, so it's not an outright ban. It's just this one, you know, the one deployment at the one telco, but it does send a very clear message to all the rest of the Huawei operating network providers here that, you know, maybe they should think twice before submitting their designs, or maybe they should just make sure it's a, you know, it's an upgrade rather than a new one. Then they have to go through a, you know, slightly less oversight and they can get away with it. But yeah, it doesn't make a whole bunch of sense when everything else is already Huawei here. So,
well, yeah, look, one thing that might shine a bit of a light on that is, you know, we all know that Huawei was allowed into the UK on the condition that there was this Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Center Oversight Board. You know, this board was going to be established and the idea was to make everything transparent and wonderful. If you look at their report from July this year, it's pretty grim reading.
Yeah, Huawei have this Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Center, which is paid for by Huawei, but staffed by GCHQ to then, you know, do a whole bunch of research. The board that oversees that report for this particular, you know, for the quarter ending middle of the year, yeah, as you say, is a little bit grim. Most of the focus reading between the lines seems to be Huawei's inability to
make good products.
Well, I mean, they certainly, at a high level, yes, that. Yeah. One of their big concerns is, of course, you know, Huawei's put a lot of stock in this particular process in the UK because they said, we provided the source code. This is the only place in the world outside of, you know, Shenzhen where you can get access to the source code. And we've shared it with GCHQ and they're, you know, reviewing it all and making sure there's no backdoors. Now, obviously backdoors or other bugs and, you know, security bugs, low quality are not the only ways that they would leverage their access, but that's the ones that this, you know, kind of process focuses on. You know, that's kind of where they've been saying, well, look, it's all right in the UK. The board's report at the moment actually focuses less on the specific quality. Oh, there are some things saying, look, engineering quality is not great. But one of the things it really highlights, which is cool, is the fact that Huawei can't reliably produce binary code that actually runs, you know, on the equipment that matches the source code that they give them. Because, you know, producing a reproducible build is actually genuinely hard. But that's a really important part of this process, is you can look at the source all you want, but if you can't assert that it is the same as what's actually live in prod, then you've got a real problem. And reading between the lines, you see a lot of real frustration you know, from this you know, review group in the UK, that they just, you know, no matter what they do, no matter how much source they read, they can, you know, they struggle with making sure it's the real thing, which, you know, kind of illustrates the challenge that, you know, with this kind of oversight and approach.
Yeah, and apparently Huawei are starting to get a bit of side eye from Germany as well.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the US obviously has been, or Flybys in general have definitely been, you know, kind of getting their ducks in a row, so to speak. I mean, we're seeing it, you know, obviously with New Zealand starting to do its part. But yeah, this is spreading outwards to some of the other allies. And, you know, there must be some actual smoking gun that's really started to push things around.
You would think there's something.
And there was that report about, was it Ethiopia? Telco
Ethiopia? Oh, somewhere in Africa. I don't know if it was Ethiopia, but it was somewhere in Africa where... Yeah, bad things.
where certainly bad things were happening. And that reporting was like single source, and we didn't have a lot of good, like there wasn't a lot of good detail about whether that was.
Well you sort of wonder if it's a smoking gun or a million smoking guns, right? Like you do wonder, because it's just amazing how unanimous everyone is once they seen it. It's like they're all getting read in on it and just go, whoa, no, get that stuff away from us.
That is the impression that you get, right? That there must be something that once you're briefed on makes it pretty clear what's going on.
Yeah.
I do wonder, though, whether any of the other big vendors really could stand up to that degree of scrutiny. I'm thinking the process that Huawei is going through in the UK. Like, can you imagine a Cisco or a Juniper or an Ericsson?
That's a funny thought, actually. It did not occur to me until then. But, yeah, I can imagine, you know, Cisco trying to come up with reproducible builds for, you know.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Exactly. Like, they would all be in exactly, you know, the reports about them would look just as bad, if not worse. What Huawei is getting. So,
and they'd have
to
deal with the board flipping out every time they found hard-coded credentials. American backdoor!
Exactly right. And if we screamed American backdoor every time there was a Cisco 123 and something, then nothing would ever get deployed anywhere.
Hey, that's what we love about you, Adam Boileau, making good points. Making good points. Now, switching gears for a minute, and I remember seeing a presentation, I think it was at one of the very early KiwiCons by Mr. Paul Craig, who I bumped into in New Zealand just recently at the most recent KiwiCon. Hi, Paul, if you're listening. I hadn't seen him in years. But he did a great talk on hacking scientists, right? And basically the premise of this talk is like, you know, if you want to find some easy bugs, look at scientific software, look at engineering software, the client-side bugs in that stuff. You know, you just pick up the software, shake it, and shells fall out of it. We're seeing an industrial espionage group actually target people using AutoCAD at the moment. And I just think that's, that's specific to certain verticals and a really cheap and sensible way to go get shells.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, this particular campaign is using essentially like the macro, you know, Word macro equivalent for AutoCAD, which apparently is you stick Lisp, executable Lisp files inside the, you know, the zip that is an actual, you know, AutoCAD file. It's just a zip with a bunch of stuff in it. Yeah, you can just like stick Lisp in there and it'll run it for you. And yeah, of course, no antivirus scanners know how to parse malicious Lisp out of AutoCAD zip files.
That's right.
You end up with, you know,
no one understands those formats. I mean, look at any sort of scientific modeling software, look at any mathematics software, you know, even just notation software. That stuff is just ripe for the picking.
Yeah, it certainly is. And it makes sense, right? I mean, why go, you know, blow really expensive, you know, Windows remotes or whatever when you can just write macros and ship them in file formats that are, you know, less well known than Microsoft Word, right? It's going to absolutely work. And as you say, in a specific industry vertical, you know, like engineering, CAD design and stuff, it's going to be super effective. People ship these files all the time, you know, as part of their workflow.
Yep.
And it's absolutely going to work. They're trusted. They're going to execute. It's going to get you what you want. I mean, it's the smart way to spend your cyber dollar.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, these software packages are not going to get fixed. They are not widely distributed enough to justify assembling a 300-strong crack team to lock them down. You know, this isn't like Microsoft, Google, Apple products. These things are, you know, these companies, they cannot justify those sort of resources. And even in companies where you've got those sorts of teams, there's still bugs, right? So I just think, I think we're probably going to see more of this.
Yeah, well, it's a natural place for attackers to go, and especially, you know, when those attackers are targeting, you know, where they have actual tasking rather than just, you know, going anywhere they can, you know, if you're going after a particular industry, then it absolutely makes sense, you know. And of course, also, this software lasts a lot longer than regular desktop stuff. I mean, if you've got a industrial workflow, you know, the churning out widgets that uses AutoCAD as input, you know, you're going to be using the same version of AutoCAD for 15 years, right? You're not going to get the, apparently, AutoCAD introduced warnings about their macro in versions after 2014. Like, how many people have upgraded their AutoCAD in the last, you know, 5 years?
I don't know. I mean, they may have upgraded it, but, you know, it still moves at a glacial pace. Let's put it that way. You are going to roll the latest versions, but they don't change in the same way that other software changes, I think, is the point here.
Yeah, and certainly from the point of view of an attacker, you get a lot more return on your bug investment, right? It's going to last longer. It's going to work everywhere. It's going to get you what you want, yeah?
The stuff Paul was finding was just like real simple fuzzing, right? And just bugs galore. It was a horror show. Moving on, and the National Republican Congressional Committee, apparently they have joined the DNC in having been owned, this time by unknown attackers, but this happened during the 2018 election.
Yeah, apparently they had a bunch of email accounts compromised despite their legendarily better than DNC cyber defense techniques, which were, gloated about by Trump after DNC got owned. But yes, they got owned as well. We don't really know a whole bunch about what happened. I mean, obviously, you start with an email box and you go from there. We don't know more specifics than that. But yeah, everyone gets known.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's see if there's any more details shake out of that one in coming weeks. The Czech Republic has claimed Russia is behind multiple intrusions into government networks there.
Yeah, a bunch more phishing campaigns in the style of a couple of the regular actors, Fancy Bear and the Turla crew, been up in a couple of ministries in the Czech government. Obtaining a bunch of information from mailboxes that are compromised and using that for onwards attacks into other areas of the government. I guess this attribution to Russia is not, it's not surprising, but it does kind of continue this trend where we are seeing, sort of naming and shaming as a tool being used to try and, make this more costly for countries to go ahead and do it.
Yep. The FBI has dismantled a huge ad fraud network, apparently. It had 1 million IPs, which is quite a lot of IPs. I mean, it's amazing too, right? Like, there's not much reporting on ad network fraud these days, but there's still an awful lot of it. You see the occasional headline about, along these lines. I saw something else the other week, and I didn't include it in the show for some reason, I think for space, but, ad fraud stuff is still rife.
Yeah, this investigation run by Google, Dan Kaminsky's firm, White Ops, and the FBI went after this group called 3VE. They've been operating since about 2014. They've issued a bunch of warrants. Three people have been arrested around the world. Most of them are operating out of Russia and places around that part of the world. So maybe they won't necessarily get extradited if they get picked up there. But people who were outside of Russia have been picked up and will presumably end up in the US. But what's notable about this campaign, I guess, which was the usual sort of thing where they run a website that will, have Google ads or, whatever other ads they're trying to get on it, hosted on the site, and then they'll click on those ads, with their own bots to generate a bunch of money. They were just doing it really at scale. And that's the thing, I guess, was interesting about this particular one. I mean, we're talking, something like 10,000 websites hosting the ads, a million IPs for, proxying the traffic through, 1,000 boxes actually running fake browsers to go click on the ads. Like, really a pretty large-scale operation and certainly profits in the millions of dollars. So, yeah, pretty serious business.
It is a serious business. And, yeah, Dan's been working on that stuff for years. I mean, that's his business now is – selling services to protect advertising platforms against this, which is it's an interesting little niche. Now, other arrests, Indian police have arrested support scammers, like tech support scammers, the people who ring you up and go, hey, I need to RDP into your box because you have a terrible problem. I'm from Microsoft. They've gone in and raided 26 call centers, and this is after Microsoft has complained about it. So 63 people arrested at 26 call centers.
Which, I mean, given the amount of people that have received those calls, like, that must be a pretty small pool of the operators, but it's got to put the, put the willies up everybody else who's in that particular scammy business. Microsoft's been fighting that fight against, domestic operators in the US for quite some time. They've largely seemed to have wiped it out there.
Other stuff that I've read, it seems like some people in India who work on those jobs, I mean, they regard them really as just being a job, right? Like, getting the flag, whatever they've been tasked with, it's just seen like getting someone to sign up for a cable subscription or something. They just see it as work. So I kind of think that, people actually being arrested and maybe going to prison for it might make people think, hey, maybe this isn't just a job like any other job.
Yeah, I mean, especially when some of these call centers are, they're changing what they're doing constantly, right? You just get a contract to do this for the week and the next week you're doing, legitimate Dell support or something. So it may be, it's sort of, you'd really want to see the people who are in management getting rounded up and thrown in jail rather than necessarily the dude that is just a salaryman scamming people on the phone.
Oh, an interesting one out of China. It looks like someone's run around messing with a compiler to get their malware built into binaries being built by Chinese developers. So far, they've racked up like 100,000 infections, and they're demanding money via WeChat's like WePay service, which means I think, you know, they're going to wind up in the van pretty soon. But, you know, it looks like a pretty successful supply chain attack there.
Yeah, I mean, the exact details of this are a little bit hard to come by. We're kind of relying on Google Translate a bit here. But yeah, attacked in the supply chain to modify the tooling for one of these kind of app buildering things. And then, yeah, dropped ransomware, got that into a bunch of apps. And yeah, as you say, like getting paid through WeChat, really? I mean, I know there's been a bunch of domestic Chinese ransomware, and it's kind of carried on more so than we've seen out here in the, you know, in the Western internet. But you really would think, given the amount of surveillance that the Chinese government have on their, you know, on their internet, that it would be a really poor life choice to go and try this out. I mean, and that you wouldn't end up in the van very, very quickly.
Yeah, into the van, buddy.
Yeah.
Just go stand out the front of your house right now. The van is coming.
Yeah.
I think is the TLDR there.
Yeah.
Kubernetes. Apparently there's a pretty bad bug in Kubernetes. And, you know, the write-up here says, wow, you know, this is Kubernetes' first major security hole. And it's, you know, I've seen a couple of people on Twitter saying, well, in fact, no, it's not. It's just the first one to actually get a CVE. And I believe you were telling me about some comments by Jesse Frizzelli saying, you know, well, you know, no one's really looked too hard at Kubernetes yet, and there's probably a lot more to find here. This is a big deal considering, like, everybody's using Kubernetes these days.
Yeah, it certainly has cropped up absolutely everywhere. I mean, lots of people have been into, you know, virtualization, and then everyone got into containerization, and Kubernetes is the, you know, the winning container orchestration system. And we really do just see it absolutely everywhere now. I mean, every modern hipster shop that wants to containerize everything, it's what they're using. And we're seeing it on top of clouds, you know, cloud provided services. And we're seeing it crop up, you know, inside, you know, for example, Red Hat OpenShift, you know, is built on top of it. So it really is absolutely everywhere. There's loads of production workloads running on it these days.
So the question becomes, is this the starter's pistol, right? Or is this just one big, you know, egregious bug, and there's probably not more like that? I feel like it could be the beginning of something wonderful, Adam.
Well, perhaps so. I mean, you know, we haven't seen a whole load of bugs in it, and this one is pretty bad, to be honest.
Walk us through it, man.
Yeah, so the bug in this particular case is when you make a request to the kind of the API endpoint of the Kubernetes thing, as you know, with your client software, to say, hey, I'd like to, you know, spin up a container or do other something, even just kind of query information about the environment, that then hits the front end API server, which then figures out which component on the back end you need to talk to, goes off, makes that request for you, and gives you the response back. In this particular case, what you can do is you can inject new messages into that communications channel once it's been established, and at that point you're talking down a socket from the, you know, the kind of the trusted component into the middle of the Kubernetes system, and then you're using the authentication credentials of that API server to then talk onwards to other components, and you can tell it to do whatever you want, you know, run arbitrary code essentially. So the net result is anyone who can talk to your Kubernetes API server, even without necessarily their own authentication in some situations, can then just execute arbitrary code and, you know, compromise your entire container infrastructure.
Hooray.
Which is really bad.
It is, man. And there was a bit of confusion. I saw, you know, there was a bit of confusion about whether or not this was pre or post auth, but it definitely looks like it's pre auth.
Yeah, so I mean, there are some you know, configurations in which you would have to have auth. Not everybody has the no auth required for kind of information enumeration bits turned on. But, you know, a lot of people have their Kubernetes sitting on the internet right now and are going to get, oh, have probably already been owned by someone rolling this out. And it breaks the entire containerization system. And lots of people have been kind of treating containerization as a replacement for other security segregation tech. And this is, you know, you've put a lot of eggs in one basket. You've got to hope that basket's really good, and yeah, not today. And then, of course, the next question is, now what? The thing that worries me about this particular bug, I mean, obviously it's a bad bug, lots of things are going to get lots owned, but the other two aspects are, do you know if you got owned? Well, there's no logs, which is kind of a problem, because it's, you know, the particular requests that you're looking at, you're not going to be able to spot in what limited logs there are. And then the second thing is, well, what do? And the answer is, well, upgrade your Kubernetes. It's like, well, have you ever done that?
Yeah.
Like on your, you know, 600 container, you know, application, have you?
Oh,
ever
no, everything's broken now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You just wonder how much they've changed it, because it's a relatively new piece of technology.
Yeah, and I mean, there's lots of people who've, you know, picked an old version of Kubernetes and never anticipate having to change it because it's in the background, it's not exposed to their workload, and they think, therefore, it's not going to be a problem. Well, now you've got a real big problem, and yeah.
Well, I mean, surely a solution here is to keep it hidden. But I mean, well, I suppose like once you get onto one, once you pop one container, then propagation becomes a bit easy, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I mean, the exact situation where you've popped a workload, but you don't necessarily have auth onwards. I mean, that's a scenario that is going to be perhaps different between each setup and may not. I don't know if there's a universal pop a container. You know, pop a workload in a container and then immediately be able to escape.
Does Kubernetes expose this API to its containers? It doesn't need to, but there are
some reasons why you might. So in some configurations, yes, you will be able to. I mean, certainly if the network is just all glued together in one blob, absolutely. But it's not 100%. But regardless, you're still going to need to fix your Kubernetes. And that's where I think things are really going to get off the rails for people because you know, it isn't going to be easy to do.
All right, well, fun stuff for cloud people.
Yep, they're going to continue to have a bad time, I guess.
That's right. We've seen some UPnP action on the internet, according to Akamai.
Yeah, UPnP is one of those things that just, you know, there's no end of creative ways to use it for badness. Someone's been using it to go around the internet, finding people with OpenPNP on their home routers, and then configuring it to port forward things from the internet inwards towards, you know, Windows machines on the internal network, and then owning them with Eternal Blue, which, yeah, smart move, well thought through. And let's face it,
if you're the sort of person who has PNP externally facing, you're probably the sort of person who's going to be vulnerable to Eternal Blue.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of people rely on the fact they're behind address translation and not directly reachable. And, you know, that is a reasonable thing to rely on, unless you've got UPnP turned on, which, yeah, a lot of people do. A lot of people's home routers have it turned on. And, yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing how many routers I've seen, like home routers, where that's turned on by default, too.
Yeah, I mean, almost all of them, I think, because it makes a bunch of, you know, video conferencing and rubbish games from the early 2000s work well. But I think we're going to see, you know, more ransomware, you know, some of the older strains that relied on Eternal Blue, you know, we might see crop back up again with a bit of UPnP action.
Microsoft has put an advisory out because some people have written rubbish apps that install, you know, root certificates on people's machines, and now they've leaked their keys, and, you know, that's bad.
Yes.
So they've even put out an advisory on that. But I mean, yeah, like, be careful what software you install, I think is the message here.
Yeah, that was Sennheiser, their like headphone manufacturer.
I'm wearing a set of them right now. And oddly enough, didn't need to install software anywhere to use them.
Yeah, I think it was like they have a internet telephony, like a soft phone product, and that was for configuring that. And
well, I think the good news is probably like only 3 people on the planet have actually installed it.
Probably. One hopes so. But yeah, installing root certs in the CA, it's not a thing anyone should be doing. So don't do that, vendors. Don't do it.
Do not do that. Now, you just mentioned video conferencing earlier. Project Zero has just done a wonderful write-up on WebRTC, basically, and video conferencing and stuff. Tell us about this write-up. Yeah, and it's from Natalie Silvanovich. Well done,
yeah, Natalie. Natalie Silvanovich is always good value. This is part one of an ongoing journey into internet video conferencing. This one talks about WebRTC, and she walks through the process that she went through, looking at the implementations of WebRTC in browsers, the way the video conferencing works. Did a bunch of fuzzing, found a bunch of pretty sweet bugs, and apparently the next blog post is going to cover the same kind of approach of end-to-end fuzzing that she took against FaceTime. So that should be good and fun. And the write-ups are always, you know, top quality, and really, you know, if you're a Vuln researcher, Project Zero's blog is just, you know, it should be the thing that you read over your morning coffee every day.
WebRTC is just this really weird thing that I don't like because it's sort of voodoo.
Yeah, well, I mean, anything that, you know, bodges.
It breaks NAT, right? Like, it's sort of. I don't know. I don't know. It's a weird signal, you know, signaling thing built to kind of get around NAT, and it's just you can do some funky stuff with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, anything that, you know, like UPnP, right? I mean, anything that allows people to negotiate, have, you know, clients that can't otherwise reach each other, negotiate other network protocols to connect, you know, via Stun or whatever else. Yeah, it does change the way that your network is laid out in a way that perhaps is surprising to people who rely on NAT.
Now, just a story from the Financial Times that I would like to mention is they've written a bit of a feature, and it's written by Oliver Ralph, who is apparently the Financial Times insurance correspondent, because, of course, being the Financial Times, they have an insurance correspondent. Can you imagine? Like, I wonder if Oliver grew up wanting to be an insurance correspondent. You just never know. But look, he's written a really interesting feature here about, you know, disputes between companies that are getting owned and their insurers.
Yeah, and I mean, insurance is certainly one of those things that people have gone, well, you know, cybersecurity is really hard. Buying insurance is a thing we understand. We can outsource that to, you know, the risks and all that to our insurer and get on with our, you know, MBA ordained life. Yeah, turns out not that straightforward. One of the examples given here was a bank in Virginia that sued its insurance company after it had a bunch of losses. It claimed $2.5 million. The insurer turned around and offered them $50,000, and they're now in the process of lawsuit against their insurer.
It's like saying, "I would like a martini, please." It's like, "I cannot help you with that. Would you like a peanut?"
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, insurance is one of those things that people would like to rely on, but the fine print in any, you know, in any industry is that you're having insured is obviously important, and in cyber, everything is even more complicated.
Well, it's misunderstood too. I think this type of insurance is widely misunderstood because it's not to cover you from all losses stemming from an incident. You know, like that's not what this is about. It's just some things that you can cover if you're, you know, you must, and you must be this high to enter and that sort of thing. It's not just some cure-all. You can't just, you know, not pay attention to security, buy yourself an insurance policy and everything's sweet. You know, that's not how it works.
Yes, some people would very much love it to be how it works, and they will find that out the hard way. There's some interesting stats in the story about, you know, kind of what percentage of claims are denied in the US, which is less than I imagined. One of the examples you gave was that the rate of denials was like single-digit percentage versus, you know, 10 to 15 in other lines of business, which, you know, that is less than I thought. But yeah, if you're in the market or you have cyber insurance, it's probably worth a read.
Okay, mate. Well, we've nearly finished this week's news, but before we go, we got to bring back a segment that is loved by Risky Business listeners, which is the Comedy Bug segment.
Yes, the good old-fashioned skateboard and dog bug of the week. This week goes to a Linux component called PolicyKit, which is responsible for, you know, plumbing in modern Linux desktops. The bug that was reported is that apparently if you have a Unix user ID that is greater than signed in max, so, you know, more than a couple of billion, apparently you can just talk to systemd across the PolicyKit socket, and it'll just auth you as if you were root. Which, yeah,
I mean, that's a good one.
On a normal Linux box, you're probably not going to have 2 billion local users, but there are many situations in which, you know, UIDs are not, you know, linearly incrementing. You know, if you have auth off, you know, SMB or LDAP or some external auth like that, or you, as an attacker, you can control the UID from some other place, it might actually be a very real local privesc. But yeah, what a stupid bug.
It's a fun one. It's good for laughs.
I certainly laughed. Yes, yeah. A jolly chortle.
All right, mate. Well, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'll speak to you again next week, which will be the final weekly Risky Business News Edition for 2018.
Yeah. Oh, thanks very much, Pat. It's nice to be back on the news segment after Alex's work last week. And yeah, I'll look forward to being here next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. And yes, I am aware of the irony at play in me teasing someone for being an insurance correspondent for the Financial Times when I've been reporting on hacking and computer stuff for 17 years. Glass houses, stones. Yes, I'm a hypocrite. But anyway, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Dave Lewis of Duo Security. And the topic is BeyondCorp. BeyondCorp is an architecture concept in IT that's kind of simple. It harks back to other ideas we've had around deperimeterization, the idea being that, you know, if you have a bunch of user machines that have a way to make various assertions to the applications and servers that they connect to, those assertions might be things like, my kernel is okay, or I am this user on my regular workstation logging in with these multiple factors. Well, that just puts you in a better place. An architecture built on very strong authentication that has the ability to provide some level of assurance with regard to system integrity. You know, once you have that, a whole bunch of security problems just go away. If users have to provide their identity before they can even access an application, I mean, you know, you're just in a better place, right? And it makes a whole bunch of issues associated with running, you know, very complicated legacy networks disappear. So, you know, it's a better way to achieve, you know, it's also a better way to achieve some of those old school, like NAC, Network Access Control goals. Now, Duo Security is very, very invested in pushing BeyondCorp as an architecture and a strategy. I mean, it is in their interests because their technology is an enabler of key facets or key aspects of BeyondCorp. And when I was in Las Vegas for Black Hat this year, I had the good fortune to sit down and talk about a lot of this stuff with Doug Song, or as you'll hear us describe him in this interview, InfoSec Yoda. Doug is a very, very sharp guy, and he really does have a vision around this stuff. So, you know, he's a believer, and that's very clear when you speak to him. Duo Security's global advisory CISO is Dave Lewis, and he joined me for this interview about various aspects of BeyondCorp. And in my experience, it's CISOs from technical backgrounds who seem to be embracing BeyondCorp most enthusiastically. But I asked Dave if that's what he's seeing too, and here's what he had to say.
Well, honestly, I see this as something that is starting to pick up. And it's more of a case of you're trying to make a cultural shift, right? So you have people that are so used to, just like take MFA as an example, multi-factor authentication as one example. As something as simple as that, you're moving from static passwords to doing multi-factor authentication. This is something that is like bringing fire to the village in a lot of cases, because people have always done the same thing the same way. And the lather, rinse, repeat is something that they're used to. So once you try to get them to shift their way of thinking, shift the way they're approaching things, it's not an easy thing to sell people on, because, you know, people are basically adverse to change.
Yeah. It's remarkable to me that, that the number of enterprises that aren't using, you know, just basic two-factor auth on admin accounts, for example, right? Like, that just blows my mind, because it's such an easy win.
Oh, absolutely. One organization I worked at years ago, for example, we did an audit of all the passwords in our environment, and we found administrative level accounts that had easily guessed passwords associated with them. And in one particular case, the admin in particular had actually passed away 2 years previous, and nobody had thought to reset their account. They had actually left the company 8 years before that. So yeah. It was just, you know, these are the kind of things that, you know, if there's not a proper staff ad remove process, they are going to fall afoul of these sort of things. And a lot of organizations need to do that.
But, you know, BeyondCorp isn't just about two-factor auth, right? Like,
not even all, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but what I love about it is it's, you know, it's a pretty much an end-to-end vision for an architecture, right? And some of that's, you know, and that's going to get increasingly effective as like hardware support moves along, and we've got sort of crypto verified everything and, you know, trustworthy endpoints and things like that. But it's possible to kind of sketch out a rudimentary BeyondCorp architecture now. Can you think of many organizations that you know that, you know, just have made that leap, you know, maybe leapfrogged the middle stage of, hey, we're rolling two-factor auth, to straight up, we're embracing this vision?
Oh, I do know several companies, but I don't know which ones I'm actually able to talk about, because not all of them want to actually discuss their security structure publicly. Yeah, but I am familiar with quite a few of them. And I would always like to see more, because I think this is a really great manifestation of things that we should have been doing 20 years ago. You know, network zone segmentation, authentication, cryptographically, you know, taking care of all the data that's going across your network, and even the APIs. These are the things that are exposed publicly that, you know, people don't really take into account. They're worried about, you know, oh, like somebody's going to log into the administrative account, but they don't pay attention to the APIs. So these are all bits and pieces, they're all coming together, and it's becoming a perfect storm of awesomeness in many ways.
A perfect storm of awesomeness. It's great. I like, because as I say, I'm on board the BeyondCorp train. Don't worry. Next stop, awesomeness. But you know, it certainly looks like it's trying to cover some older ground, right? This is like a reimagining of NAC in a lot of ways, right? Like, the thinking was back then that you would verify the trustworthiness of a endpoint and authenticate it at a network level, right? And that there was some solid thinking there, but the tech was shit, right? Like, at the end of the day, it was just too hard.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've gone out of our way to make sure that we're making it easier for, you know, companies to use it, easier for the consumer to be able to process it. You know, something as simple as, you know, green for yes, red for no. This is something that, you know, democratizing security in a lot of ways, making it simpler for people to use. Because there's so many apps out there that historically, you know, PGP is an example. I tried teaching that to my parents, my septuagenarian parents, and yeah, that didn't go well. Suffice to say that what fell by the wayside, but that's just one example of you want to make things easier for people to use so that they will actually adopt it and make use of it.
Yeah. Now, look, we've got the full BeyondCorp, right, which is where you've got apps that only expose attack surface after a user is authenticated. That user's, endpoint, it has had some integrity checking applied to it. You know, it's like there's some crypto magic that does some basic integrity checking. They are multi-factor authed, right? So it's this all singing, all dancing vision. You know, that's not going to be a suitable architecture for every shop, right? So, you know, can you be half BeyondCorped?
You know what? Yes. And the reason I look at it, the moniker of zero trust, I like to look at it more of along the lines of unified access security, a wrapper that's around everything from a security perspective, but done in a way that is approachable. And I think, yes, you can get there because a lot of people talk about zero trust as a be-all, end-all, as an end state. And honestly, every incremental change is a win in a security perspective. If you are able to, provide proper authentication for your users, provide proper security paradigm across all of your devices, each one of those steps is a win. So yes, you can be partway there. Obviously, there is no certification or anything to that effect as to what is zero trust, or what I prefer to say is unified access security, but it is an iterative process. And I think that, ultimately we can get to that nirvana-like state, but it's going to take time.
I think it's going to take a lot of time, like just having been in this industry long enough to see how slowly things actually move. But for the first time, like it feels like we've got a clear direction and this is it.
Yes, and that's what gives me hope in this regard, is that we do have a clear direction.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like it is the architecture, isn't it? And it's going to be the way of doing things in the future, and that is simply because it is the secure way of doing things.
Absolutely, and this is why we should listen to Yoda.
Yes, InfoSec Yoda, Mr. Doug Song, who is, but seriously, I mean, you sit down with Doug, you talk to him about stuff like this, and it is just so clear. I mean, the clarity of his vision on this stuff is remarkable.
It absolutely is. And he is, I'm always reticent to use terms like visionary, but he really is. He's actually the epitome of that type of mindset. He can see things before they happen in many ways in a security perspective. And I think that he has really given us a good path to walk on, for sure.
Now, look, I mean, of course, Duo has been acquired by Cisco, and a company like that can do a lot to unlock the that type of vision. How's that all progressing, or is it still just really early days at the moment? Because I imagine, things like that, they're very complicated. Being acquired by a company like Cisco, I'd imagine, is a very complicated process.
Well, yes, as with any acquisition, this is the first time on the being acquired side. So this is a new aspect for me, and it's really been fantastic. And the folks in Cisco have gone out of their way to make us feel welcome, make us feel part of the family. And it's really providing us this fantastic opportunity, because we've gone from a 700 person shop to 70,000 overnight. And this has opened up all sorts of possibilities for us to really push home the unified access security vision.
Now, look, one area where there's, the missing piece, I guess, from a, Duo Cisco point of view, that last missing piece has got to be around application security. And it's the part of the BeyondCorp vision that, is kind of least spoken about. And I guess that's because, it's a very, once you're dealing with, such strongly authenticated users, you can really just hide any sort of vulnerable code or potentially vulnerable code from users until after they've authenticated. Is that why we don't really hear so much about that side of the BeyondCorp stuff?
I don't know the rationale as to why we don't hear more about that, because it is a really salient discussion to be having. Because, yes, we're taking care of the users and all that, but once you take care of that aspect and you've, devalued the monetary aspect of a username and password, then the attackers are going to shift their focus and they're going to come after the APIs. Not that they're not already, but this is one of those things where we want to make sure we're authenticating all the data flows and things to that effect. Like, one great example was a friend of ours, and I say that in the industry, added a whole bunch of people using the Twitter API. This was years ago. And all of a sudden, overnight, he had 2,000 followers, but nobody had added him. It was a feature in their API that he was able to go through and add users to his account. So, it's a very simple aspect, but it just shows the possibilities if you extrapolate from there as to what can happen if APIs are not properly authenticated before use. And to be fair, even if it's internal, it should really be the same mindset. I mean, historically, we saw people with hardened servers that were facing the internet, but internally, I mean, I worked in one shop where they had an entire Microsoft Office suite installed on production servers that were internal because the rationale was, oh, it's okay, we're behind a firewall. That doesn't really stand up. And honestly, as networks become more and more diverse and in their structure, we really have to make sure that we're approaching servers on the inside the same as we would externally facing.
All right. Well, Dave Lewis, thank you very much for joining us to talk about, how it's all tracking, how, you know, Beyond Corp as a adopted philosophy is tracking along, and also for giving us a bit of insight into how things are going post-acquisition. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Dave Lewis of Duo Security there. You can check out Duo's stuff at duo.com. And as you probably gathered from that interview, Duo is now a part of Cisco. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back on Monday with part two of our most recent Snake Oilers podcast series. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.